The forum tonight, as most of you perhaps know, is a question: is there a Christian economic? And there will be a couple of presentations. First will be Norbert Doerl, who is an economist at North Dakota State University. And the second one will be Larry Rasmussen, who is a professor at Wesley Theological Seminary. I simply asked them to spend a couple minutes speaking to that question. I don't know if they have both the same answer or different ones, and what their rationales are. Following those two, we will open to straight discussion, and we just assume you not focus it necessarily to those two, although it's obviously okay to have clarification questions, but that it move from there, let those be just kind of beginners for us, and then we have the dialogue together. I will be responsible for keeping it flowing. Don't take personal if I start to close one of you down and move to another. If you can be kind enough to raise your hands, I'll kind of keep track of what order there is. If you're getting neglected, which can happen, rap on that thing or jump up and down or somehow make sure I get your attention. At least one person has asked if you would be kind enough to speak up when you speak for the benefit of hearing problems for some, and also for the taping, but more I'm concerned about persons who might have trouble hearing, if you'd be kind enough to speak up. For those of you who are afraid, I know that's something that you don't care to hear, but it's important. Okay, again, in case some came a little late, is there a Christian economic? And Norbert Doerl is going to first share a few thoughts around that question. Norbert?
Hey, I think Frank Lee is a good moderator for this kind of a topic because he kind of enjoys a little bit of conflict and ideas, and so this may be a place for it. I think it's called a fitting subject for Holden Village because we're dealing about lifestyle and certainly economics that affect our lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I'm not an authority on the Christian economic. Larry Rasmussen is he's a theologian, so he might bring more of the Christian part of what I read part of his book, so I may steal part of his story, I'm not sure. But the what I'm a concerned Christian layman, I consider myself as such, with some training in economics. So we talk about that, we define economics as a science. We would say that the science of an allocation of resources was production of goods and services for things that people want or think they want or express themselves, or might think of it as being optimum allocation of resources. So if we ask the question, is there a Christian economics as a science, we would also have to ask then, is there a Christian biology or Christian medical science or Christian genetics or Christian engineering? And I suppose really wouldn't say these sciences are more Christian than economics is Christian. But rather, I think we're concerned about the Christian viewpoint towards the science, whether it's economics or biology or particularly on the medical science, and we talk about genetic engineering, and so these are Christian concerns as they are in economics. And so with that as a kind of a starting point, I would say that as a Christian, we can ask, is there a Christian concern about whether or not we should try to manipulate the economy, try to achieve certain goals that we as Christians think are important? And as we think about the importance of both, you know, people around us, people in the country, or people around the world. And as we talk about the various economic systems in the world, we have, of course, at the extremes, we in theory, we talk about pure capitalism on one extreme, perhaps the other extreme, pure socialism. There are none of these in the real world, even we call the U.S. a capitalistic system. Basically, it's very much moderated with social aspects, or even the socialist countries are moderated with capitalistic or aspects. So there is no Christian economic system as such. We ask what is meant by resources. We tend to sometimes think in terms of land and capital and oil and coal and metals and so forth, when really the greatest resource in the world is really the human resource. We as people, the thing we as Christians say we're concerned about. Whether it's the whether we love our neighbor. So we are a resource and people are a resource. And if we ask the question, what really accounts for the big difference among, or let's say, income between the poor and the rich, within our country or among countries? And let's say we think in terms of those of us who are here, why can we afford to come to Golden Village and people back home can't afford to come to Golden Village? Perhaps it's probably due to the development of the human resource. In other words, by my cultural and educational background, I'm productive in society so that I can come to Golden Village. Maybe somebody else in my community did not have the same privilege or the same training as I have. His human resource is not developed if he is not as productive. Or if you think in terms of comparing countries, let's take Japan, for example, one of the now relatively rich countries in the world. They have almost no basic resources. They import their coal, or they import most of their coal, import all their oil, import their lumber, import almost everything you have to import. Nearly half their food, and still they are a very productive country because by their cultural history and their policies, they have a highly developed human resource. People are educated, they are productive, and all the other things that we measure the human resource, although we may disagree with their value system in what they produce, but in terms of their value system, they are very productive, and they are a relatively rich country. And so, also individually, we think of individually our economic value system. Again, we're talking about more than money, we're talking about allocation of our time. We decide to spend a week or two here at Golden Village as part of allocation of your time, as economic decisions. When we talk about the quality of life, and that really becomes a big open question in economics, so what is a good life? And again, the Christian viewpoint can be somewhat different than somebody else who is a non-Christian who is a materialist. Or the whole concept of pursuit of happiness, you know, what really is it? And again, there's a Christian perspective on happiness. We sat in on Mary Schramm's class over in the village this evening, and she really emphasized the whole Christian concept of using our talents and gifts for others. And so in our economic system, of course, one of the things we're concerned about is economic efficiency. The Christian viewpoint is to produce what? As Christians, we may have a different emphasis on what should be produced in society. In Larry Rafferty's book, he talks about the referendum refers to enough is best. In other words, rather than producing more and more, perhaps there is enough. And again, we have to ask, enough of what? What kinds of growth are we talking about? Because if we think in terms, let's say, during my lifetime, which relatively short in terms of history of the world, but maybe long to compare to some of you, the population of the world has more than doubled in my lifetime. And let's say that when I was a child, there's been some superpower that would have decided enough is best, let's not spend more effort on science, knowledge, and progress because enough is best. And let's say, if that would have actually happened, perhaps by this time, instead of one fourth of the people in the world being studying, it would have been because we wouldn't have developed the production of science of food production. So I think we talk about enough is best, we have to very clarify what we're talking about in terms of economic production. Because there's nothing Christian about poverty if you have to spend all your efforts in trying to survive and have no energy left to love your neighbor. So I think the question is, what is a Christian attitude toward development, the use of resources? Is really one of whether selfish motivated or developing resources to help people around us in the world. And of course, Golden Village emphasis here is to de-emphasize materialism and to still talk about efficient use of resources. And I guess, as I emphasized before, I think if we can, as Christians, really emphasize a human resource that needs help and development, and here at Golden Village, of course, we have this retreat center. But again, if you look who's here, it's middle-class whites. It's not really for all people. I mean, it's at least not available economically for all people. As we talk about efficient attitude toward economic development, I think we can really, again, be emphasizing rather materialism, more human services versus bigger things and so forth. And the also, another concept sometimes is misinterpreted. We talk about dividing the wealth of the world among the people, as though then we have to become poor. Really, wealth is a function, it's not a fixed amount. Oil is a fixed amount, the coal might be a fixed amount, but not wealth is not a fixed amount. Wealth is a function of the productivity of the people. As I compared, you know, let's say Japan to India, there's not a difference in the fixed amount of wealth, it's in the productivity of the people based on the development of the human resource. And so I think the real challenge to the Christian community is to help develop policies which can encourage the use of the great resources of this country, of our own resources, our own personal resources, to try to improve the lot of people and helping to improve themselves in education and training and opportunities for fulfillment of their life, and all the things that we think in terms of our own cultural improvements. And so currently, of course, on the national level, the current debate is that Reagan economics tends to, President Reagan is a reader of Milton Friedman, who is a strictly free enterprise economist, while the House Speaker O'Neill, of course, is more for more government involvement to distribute the opportunities for poor people. And so let's say there's no Christian economic system. There's no right answer, so there must be room for argument and debate tonight.
Thank you. Larry.
I put my notes on green paper. I thought that was appropriate. I guess what I would like to do, since, as Frank mentioned, the purpose of these opening remarks is not to debate one another, but rather each of us, simply to make a statement that might be a place for the group as a whole to begin. My appeal will be to relate dominant Christian symbols and major Christian themes to our economic life. I think the process of what the historians and sociologists often call secularization has gone extremely far, so that we do not think in the same thought of matters of economic reality and matters of Christian faith. We don't ordinarily make those connections, and my hope is that our forum might try to bring the resources of Christian faith together with our deliberations about our economic life. Let me just begin by citing an example. I think that the Eucharist is economically a rich symbol, but I don't think that we've explored the economics of the Eucharist. The biblical materials are full of the language of economics, but we don't any longer associate it with our economic life. In fact, the way of talking about the whole scheme of the creation coming to fruition is to speak of that as the economy of God. It's a Pauline phrase and a phrase that is common in early Christian theology. Or if you want to take the notion that is present in Scripture about creation, one notion is that the creation is an oikos, a house, a single public household. Our words, economics, which refers to providing for the material well-being of the household and managing it well, our words, economics and ecology and ecumenical, all stem from the same basic biblical notion. We don't think economics, ecology, ecumenical, as having a single frame of reference. My hope is that our discussion of Christian faith and economics might start making such connections. Ecumenical means regarding the whole human family as members of a single public household, the oikos. Ecology refers to that upon which the life of the household depends, and economic refers to providing for the material well-being of the household. Well, let me just, I said I was going to cite an example. Just one paragraph less than that from a book by Gustave Martelet, a French Jesuit, The Risen Christ in the Eucharistic World, as an example of how one might begin to link a major Christian symbol and economic life. Martelet writes, "To involve human food and drink symbolically in a meal of love, the Eucharist, like we celebrate on Sunday night, implies at the very least that in real life we have done nothing to deprive others of them. And even further, that we are doing or have done everything that is humanly and Christianly necessary and possible to ensure that these elementary supplies, bread and drink, are produced in sufficient quantity and shared equitably. If this were not done, to take the bread and the wine and offer them to the Lord would become intolerably false, since we would be seeking to give God with one hand what we were unjustly withholding from people with the other." There's just a little example of looking at a major Christian symbol and start thinking about the sharing of the production of resources and the sharing equitably of them, the relationship between offering material goods to God in worship and the distribution of those among ourselves and others. To the question, is there a Christian economic system? I would say sort of no, but kind of. No, in the sense that if by economic system you mean one particular way of organizing economic life, I would say no, there is no single Christian economic system. The kingdom of God is the ground of the normative Christian ethic, and in light of the kingdom of God, no human system warrants unqualified benediction. And every time the church has associated itself in an unqualified way with a particular economic system, the prophets have arisen, usually without honor, but never without absence, and pointed out that identification, whether it was the Roman Catholic Church with a feudal system or the Protestant inclination to endorse capitalism. So no, there isn't a particular Christian economic system in that sense of giving blanket sanction to the way in which economic life is organized, because the kingdom of God always transcends that, and that is the source of our ethic. But kind of. That means there are some persistent themes, some recurrent lines that function as standards and guides for those who claim the faith to not only judge economic life, but to try and shape it. One of those Norbert raised that I would argue is a notion of material sufficiency or enough, in contrast to unlimited production and maximum consumption on the one hand, which I think on Christian grounds ought not to be regarded as proper conduct, unlimited production and maximum consumption, and on the other hand, enough is best, or material sufficiency is in contrast with involuntary and degrading poverty. So there is a notion. I think throughout the scriptures you have a kind of equalizing thrust that's present, whether it's the experience of the children of Israel in the wilderness, where they clearly contrast their own economics and try to institutionalize it, clearly contrasted with that which they have experienced in Egypt. And it's an effort to provide community access to resources on the basis of need, and they try to institutionalize it. It shows up again when Solomon establishes an economics of privilege and the prophets return to the manna economics. It shows up again in the followers of Jesus when the people get their lives turned around by Jesus. There's an immediate impact on their economic life, and you can read about it in Acts 2 and Acts 4. And when Paul asks for the contribution to the churches at Jerusalem, he goes back to manna economics from the wilderness experience. There's a pattern. It's always an equalizing thrust. a notion of sufficiency for all. Well, that's a kind of guideline. It contrasts with poverty on the one hand and unlimited consumption on the other hand. There's a notion of stewardship and dominion as Christ, as a kind of Christ-like caring for all of creation, in contrast with what we've experienced for the last couple of centuries since we've demarcated ourselves since Descartes, and before that, and certainly with the Enlightenment, of ourselves over against and different from the rest of nature. So you've got a humanity-nature split. The material, Christ-like dominion and stewardship is in contrast to a kind of species chauvinism on our part, as if the whole world were simply nothing other than, and our phrase is very telling, natural resources, all there for human use. Contrast to species chauvinism, in contrast with, to a sense of time that limits our decisions about economic life to those of our own generation, in contrast to a notion of neighbor as only those who are emotionally significant for us, instead of, as the Hebrew notion, one's life was lived on in the people of God and to all future generations. So I make my decisions now in keeping with what is required for ongoing life and for generations to come. That's a different notion of stewardship and dominion, but I think it's a persistent theme. And then, lastly, an understanding of human sinfulness in Christian tradition is that we persistently, pervasively try to organize life on our terms, even if it means that our well-being is at the expense of others. That means for economic life, it seems to me, that we ought to be suspicious against all large concentrations of power, whether political or economic or social or any other kind, because the source of injustice and even of evil is the maldistribution of power. So one ought to be suspicious of large, unchecked concentrations of economic power. And then there are implications for that. So I think those three things, a notion of material sufficiency that avoids the extremes of maximum consumption, unlimited consumption on the one hand, and degrading poverty on the other, a notion of stewardship and dominion, and the notion of a kind of checking of concentrations of economic power, provide not a Christian economic system, but provide some kind of guideline. And I've just returned to original plea that we might think through some of the basic sources and symbols in Christian faith and try to link them up with economic life. It's a time now when, in my judgment, industrial society, whether it's socialist or capitalist, is confronted by a common set of problems and a common set of limits. And it's a very creative period as well as a very threatening period economically. It's creative, and it's a time that asks for us to expect some new thing. As John Yoder said, we might expect if we live life in the power of the Spirit. That's a very exciting and a very problematic time, but it's a time that invites us to think through the faith again with respect to economic systems, since the ones that we've been accustomed to are rendered more doubtful. They're still productively efficient, but they're rendered more doubtful than they have been.
Thank you, Larry. Norbert?
Open to us.
A lot thrust at us in just a few minutes there. We'll listen to Larry for a while. But I guess the issue that comes up with me in my Christian faith is a number of the so-called what media evangelists or the Christians who obviously some kind of sanction on our free economic system from a very intense capitalistic position. And theologically, I agree with him on many issues, but it comes down to a point where I don't think they're really aware of the implications of the third world or the economic structure that we're in. I'd like to get a grasp on it. You know, where, why is that so common?
Your question, say it again, why the evangelicals?
Why a number of prominent evangelicals in the media
seem
today
to be pro-capitalist without an awareness of its implications for worlds that are less productive and more starvation. Okay. We do not need to focus on the two who started, and we can go any direction, just if you need that permission. And I would guess also we do not need to be answer people. We may share frustrations or problems around the whole question for us. So please feel open to any direction.
Well, I was just going to respond to his mentioning of evangelicals. I think it's also true in our churches that there's immense unawareness of social injustice around the world. I know I myself, just in the past 3-4 years, have just had astounding things open to me from the reading of John. It's just completely new to me, and I think that it's just a beginning in educating our people or making them aware.
I think one of the real problems that I'm kind of starting to have to grapple with here a little bit is I think there's a tremendous amount of ignorance with regard to economics, the cause and effects. And I think that it's kind of sad in a way, because I do feel strongly that it's probably going to do more than anything else to either keep the atmosphere and the environment open for a Christian movement and Christian dialogue, or close one off. And I think that since so many things stem from what's happened and what's happening economically, whether it be our country or a situation like El Salvador or Russia or any place, that I think it's such an important thing that I think the biggest and the saddest thing I think that's going on, and I see more and more in my type of business, is that there really is so little understanding of economics and cause and effect. And I'm sure that's true in many other disciplines also, but economics certainly touches all of us. And I guess that's one of my real fears, how is the education brought and how are people...
Are you speaking in terms of like our ignorance of third world, and we feel like our economics isn't tied in? You're not talking about it. You're talking about individual with the state. Where is the tie-in you're speaking?
Well, I guess may just
or
bring
cause
it down,
and effect.
Yeah, bring it just down to something probably a little bit more understandable. I'm sure that we probably would have as many people as we have here different views on what they cause inflation, and if inflation in fact is bad, and then what happens after inflationary times, and what happens during recessionary times, and then after recessionary times, is there social disorder? And if there's social disorder, you know, what things are attacked? And maybe the church will be attacked, and maybe there will be not the freedom to speak like this. And different systems have certainly followed social disorder. And we can see that in history. And sometimes very oppressive systems have come in behind social disorder. And I see that as probably the area of ignorance then, is just people getting a grasp on, you know, what are the cause and effects, and what happens. And I think economics is a little understood from that end.
Okay.
I'm kind of glad that he brought the Greek word in there, because economics to me really is Greek. I listen to economics people. I see administration change and a new bunch come in. A new bunch go out. they don't, I don't hear any agreement. Everybody has a different solution, and I don't know which way to go. I really don't.
That's why it's referred to as an imperfect science.
Yeah.
Because there's so many uncontrollable variables, and because it involves people decisions in masses or individuals. And so it's unpredictable because of the people aren't predictable.
Yeah, he brought the question. Nobody seems to understand what causes inflation. And I think you get at least a dozen different answers to that if you were to ask a dozen different companies.
Alfred Kahn, Larry quotes, made a remark in 79. Anybody who isn't schizophrenic these days referring to economics that just isn't thinking clearly.
Well, we all have a right to be here now, so. You will not be declared schizophrenic if you speak next.
I'd like to comment in the form of schizophrenia that the book by Howard Ruff, the one about the surviving and the coming days.
How to prosper, dreaming.
What is it again?
How to prosper.
How to prosper. And it seems like people are really afraid of what's coming. And I know that the Mormon Church has always tried to stockpile, but it's become more common among many United States citizens. As far as even stocking up guns to protect their own stockpile. And I just was wondering if people thought of that. If it's affecting anybody you know.
Do you have some thoughts on?
I just think it's they're kind of looking forward to the day by talking about it so much and stocking themselves up on gold and everything. It's kind of like it's some kind of big excitement coming up in their life, like if you know an earthquake is going to come. I don't know. I think it's more sensationalistic than an actual realistic fear. I think they're playing on that.
I think to some extent somebody's using that to the economic system to profit, to sell some stuff. They're profiteering on the people's fears.
Yet there has to be some substance to that fear for people to follow in as much as they have. The survivalist movement is how it is too.
As confusing as the whole economic question may be, I think, for at least for me and for many people that I know, there's still a question to get down to very pragmatic kinds of things. In light of maybe not understanding a lot about economics or not understanding about the way that things work, how do we then live? What kind of things do we participate in? What kind of consumers are we? What kind of jobs do we have, and how do we view what we do? Those are questions to me that just are the everyday kinds of things, and not just the larger issue of is there a Christian economics, but as a Christian, how do I live in this economic environment?
It's in asking Larry a question. I have no problem with the idea of sufficiency as an individual, but outside of a socialist system, I don't see how we could. I have not seen a blueprint for sufficiency as a nation. For going with the idea of sufficiency, who decides? I know it's sufficient for me, or what I believe is comfortably sufficient for me. But do I have the right to say that as to what's sufficient for Bud and what's sufficient for Larry? How do you take that from an individual to a nation?
I'd like to speak to that. I think that we have a tendency in this generation to have other people dictate laws for us, and so that we do the same and dictate. Such that we should educate the people in the world so that they know about the other problems. we should educate people to be more aware of what's going on, and we're constantly dictating laws of what other people should be doing. But I think that Christian economics is more of a personal thing, in which case the only dictating is done personally, so that there's no one person saying, this is sufficient for you. But somehow we have to turn this around. So instead of thinking in the general fashion of this is the way it should be for everyone, that we should get down and say, how can I become more Christian economically?
I think you're misreading my statement. If I consider my Christianity in terms of the corporate body, and not just a personal pietistic walk with Jesus, what I'm saying is that I have no problems with, for myself, with sufficiency, and with trying to let, you know, struggling with letting that out. The issue for me is, how do we do that as a body? Not just as a church body, how do we do that as a nation? How do you influence the nation?
What's the national game plan for?
Yeah. How do you do that on a nationwide scale?
You're speaking of in a capitalistic society.
Put it in our pedals right now.
I think I kind of hear what she's saying. She says you don't start at the top.
No, I agree.
You could do it at a grassroots level.
Once you started at your own level, how do you go beyond that?
I think it would have to be, what she's saying, a growing kind of thing.
Grassroots level.
The Christian community probably doesn't adhere to sufficiency along your lines. Total Christian community. Some Christians do, some don't. Mm-hmm. If they all did, that would be a start. As a spreading kind of thing, to not abuse and overuse, etc.
Well, I mean, this is not addressing that, but it's something that brought to my mind when I hear this, is that if in fact one is going to work actively to move in a direction, and whatever direction each person thinks he should move in, and because of his Christian belief, etc., he certainly has to eventually get to a point where he knows, you know, what's going on, to at least act with it. And just as an example, it just blew my mind, but I started to read about the Federal Reserve System, and I imagine we could go through this whole group here, and luckily maybe one out of 100 would know the real workings of the Federal Reserve System. Now, I'm just pulling that out as an example. That is a very important part of our economic system here in the United States. It has meaning, you know, every moment of our life, because it actually affects what we're doing and how the money is created, interest rates, and all these other type of things. And yet, there would be very few in this room, and even after reading two or three books on it, it's difficult for me to understand also, is it a government body, is it not? It was horrifying to even know it's not even a government body, it's really owned privately. So these are the types of things that I think have to be addressed by each individual, and how he gets to that is the question. Where do you go to get those answers? Because certainly you're not getting them from at least the papers and the TVs and this and that. Maybe there's a reason for not getting it.
I think one corporate body that is working for subsistence survival for the world would be Bread for the World. The fact that they work within the existing political system through lobbying and also communicating to the people what they possibly can do as individuals working as a group.
I would like to just get us all plugged in case some of you are getting a little tired and thinking it's theory. It seems to me that most times you go to the ballot box, you're voting some economic stuff, and not just Proposition 13 or whatever it is in each particular county or state, but like with the Reagan administration, it seems to me there was a lot of economic, at least belief, that there was a resounding economic change that was felt on the part of the people. So it seems to me we're always into it, whether we like it. It's not just personal. The budget gets approved or changed each year, which deals with a lot of economics. Not, I just throw that out so we talk on that level also, maybe, that we are into it.
I wonder what the people here think about the Reagan budget cuts in the area of social services.
You have some feelings?
Is anybody else?
I think in a lot of ways it's pretty frightening. And then in some ways, not too long ago I read in a Seattle paper where the chore service was threatened to be really cut back, and where now the Catholic churches in Seattle picked that up, and a lot of it, I don't know what percent, but quite a lot of it is being done now on a voluntary basis, so it's not costing anything. So maybe that, you know, if that would trigger something like that off, that would be a plus. But then I still am frightened of, you know, a lot of people really being hurt by it too.
In a very unsystematic way, you know, in terms of thinking out loud, response to Norm's question, on the surface, it seems that it's caused a great deal of fear. And a lot of people have retrenched on the basis of the raising budget cuts for the social services. But I'm wondering if it's not possible that it could be an opportunity in another dimension, that in fact it causes not just a Christian community that is sensitive to that issue, but others who may not be a part of that family, to look more closely at the human potential and the resources that exist within the human community. And I know that a lot of task forces and ad hoc kinds of committees have been formed, you know, to deal specifically with that issue, and a lot of very creative things, you know, have come out of that squeeze. Now that looks to me like an opportunity for those who are imaginative enough, you know, to take, you know, either biblical or extra-biblical impulses and make very pragmatic application of that to a corporate life. And I guess I would like to see some of that more visible, and some of the things that people have done under those circumstances and brought more into the public light. But the word I like to use is opportunity. It doesn't perhaps look like that to a lot, but to some it has become an opportunity to say, well, now what are we going to do? And perhaps we've leaned on the handouts of a liberal government long enough, of government help, and perhaps it's a time for us to examine what really can we do.
I guess, again, in a Christian theory, that sounds fine. But as a church structure or any other private structure, we're not geared up to serve the masses, I mean, or the, you know, the great numbers of people that are in that power situation. So even though this would test that theory, there'd be millions as long as the slacks who would not be benefited, maybe, you know, so-called left behind.
Nor is that because people don't have enough interest in helping people out, or what do you feel about?
Well, if you think of, see, many times your poor people are concentrated in the ghettos of the big cities, and there are just not enough people there to help your neighbor, because, you know, neighbors are also poor. And, you know, I think, if you think of my situation, Fargo, people of Fargo are wealthy enough, they could, you know, take care of the poor people, I suppose, without great sacrifice. But in terms of, if you think of the large concentration in some areas of the country, there's just no institutional setup to take care of.
Well, didn't there used to be, though, before the government got into this? Didn't the church have that role and
could I just break in, apart from that, I think what Norm is saying is that if we use racism now, throw that in, that by and large, maybe classism is better, that people who have resources do not choose to live next to those who don't, and so we do form large ghettos made up of basically poor and disenfranchised people, and so neighbor to neighbor doesn't work because we build walls around that with highways, and they're left ones, they're left out ones, and so me taking care of my brother or sister is not a very manageable way of doing it. That's what Norm's saying. So agrarian to city world has made some real changes.
On the other hand, if a church organization, a synod or a district, looks at it instead of being an individual church looking at it, and allocates resources to this thing as on a hand where it can't do it, and I don't know. But I know that at one time that was one of the big functions of the church. Hospitals were built by the church. Charity was taken care of by the church. It seems to me that what happened is when the government came into it, the church kind of came out by default. And is this time that we have to reconsider the possibility of going back into this again?
I think any church anywhere can deliver a humanitarian service about 20 times as effectively as the government can. If you take a look at the delivering dollars to some specific community, something pitifully low, like 5 to 8 cents on the dollar, and the government gets to that need, whereas 90 to 95 cents on the dollar given to a church gets delivered to that need.
I don't know. I guess I would question that whole assumption, because if you think of your whole welfare program, this is direct welfare transfer to people. That isn't just paid out someplace else. This is direct welfare transfer to people. 100% of all the administration costs.
Well, the administration costs are so high, though.
Oh, yeah. I worked in a ghetto with a lot of third generation welfare recipients. And I think the difference between a social service and a church service would be getting those people motivated out of their situation. When they grow up expecting social services by the third generation, their ignorance is almost bliss by the time. They really don't care if they move anywhere but where they are. I'm saying by default, because that's where it is ignorance. And I think I agree that the church and people themselves should be responsible for the native community, and not laid on the federal or the state or county government.
Yep.
I just want to say that my feeling would be that even if we did that as a church, that if we just give to our neighbor and try to alleviate their situation without changing our own approach, our own attitudes, our own values, our own way of life, that we're really just doing what the federal government is doing. So we're do-gooding. We're out there doing some canned goods, and we're out there helping some people with something that they need help with, but that we're really not making any kind of impact. We're just perpetuating the system. And I guess I would ask the question, I'd ask this of myself too, and I don't think that I'd be much different than the rest of you, is that how, you know, what do we do when we go home from here? What, you know, what is our life like? Is it different from the way it is when we live here? What is our consumption like? Is it different than when it is when we're here at Holden Village? What is our use of food like? Do we bring the leftovers back to the table the way we get them here, and soups and other kinds of things? Do we deny ourselves things at home the way we do here? I don't know if this is ideal either, but I think probably all of us have to work at somehow changing the way we live and sharing that change with and bringing that change and that difference to other people. And that unless it begins with us individually, that we can't do much about it corporately.
You get your own house in order.
Yeah. I don't know how we can support something or even work towards something if we don't live it. You know, it just becomes a lot of hot air and a lot of do-gooding, I think. Unless we really look at our own lives and look at our own excess and look at our own problems and try to deal with that first.
So again, it comes back to my earlier statement. The poor people are not poor because of our excess. They're poor because of race. Comes back to your question of come out here. Their human potential has never been developed. They're not poor because I'm rich.
I'm not saying that they're poor because of our excess. What I'm saying is that saying is that if we hope to do anything about changing the system, that we have to change it first with ourselves. We can't say to ourselves, we'll continue the way we're going and we'll make the system different. But we're not going to make the system different, and we're not going to ever help anybody else really if we're not living it ourselves.
Are you wondering? One of the things that comes to my mind, I don't know if the data is accurate, so I'd like some help. When we start talking about how well the church did, my mind says that the stuff about the poverty in America was atrocious prior to, let's make sure everybody has food and housing in this country, which was a big move, I remember, right, a few years ago. It seems to me that the church wasn't doing so well, and the fact is we have developed a system where we were beginning to at least have people eating decent food and many of them having housing. Now, I may not remember history well, so if that's incorrect, then that needs to be challenged. If it is correct, why are we so disgruntled with that particular thing? Or is it costing us too much, or what's the issues around it?
The other problem, I think, is that the people, since welfare people, and people have been on welfare for, say, 2-3 generations, they do not have training so that when they go to jobs that they're able to earn money enough to live. They need the extra support of the government or of welfare. And the other thing that happens is that they make and get more money on welfare than they do working. And so there's no incentive to work.
I'd just like to comment as a kind of piggyback to that even though the church as one community is thrown back upon its own resources, and others also, I don't think that means that we need to resign ourselves to the fact that that's the way it's going to be. I think that state cannot be let off the hook, as it were, and that the church has a prophetic task at that point. When we talk about separation of church and state, that doesn't mean there can't be institutional cooperation. And therefore, I think that if our righteous indignation, if you will, reaches a certain level, and we can somehow get our act together, our oikos, at that point, I think we have a job to do. With the state. And I think that's a good answer. The church is not here to save the world. The church, even if it were designed to do that, couldn't do it. So I think that there's got to be some sense in which, even though we are in this position now, and we have to be imaginative about the resources we use, we still have to call the state to task.
But we can't ask the state to do something that we're not doing ourselves. We can't expect the state to do for us something that we don't do for ourselves. That we have to be able to, it seems to me, we have to say to ourselves, what is my pattern like? What am I doing? In my church, anyway, we have, a great church, but we don't talk a lot about what it is that how many cars we buy, or what it is that we have to have, and what kinds of houses we live in, and the kinds of accessories that we have as people. And I think we all do. We all have probably, but most of us have lots more than we need. And yet, how can we continue to live that way and then expect that somebody else is going to take care of the needs of, or the state's going to take care of the needs of those who don't have it?
Well, that may be the Christian conscience, but that isn't the popular piety. that we look at our own style of life before we begin saying something to the government. I think that may be the Christian conscience, for me it is, and I certainly support you, but that isn't popular piety.
Well, but even if it isn't popular, we can only do what we can do.
Could I ask again, I need this clarification, get near the end, and I might have to pass the mic. Who writes our economic policy, powerless or those who lack power, rich or poor? What does it mean that we say that we stand with the poor, whether we're rich or poor, as the Church of Christ, because we believe Christ does that? Those things, it seems to me, are real issues of conflict for me. They drive me crazy, but it seems to me they're issues. Whether or not I call it Christian economics, I do have to ask the question whether the economic policy of the country is for everybody or for a certain group, no matter how it pinches down on me, it seems to me. Yeah.
Well, just a comment, and I pick it up a little bit over there, is that if you want to go back and listen to Bill, he's mentioned that if we don't have it within ourselves to do it first, cite another example. Inflation is not fair. In other words, it treats people differently. It depends where you are in the inflationary spiral. If you're the first one to get the newly printed dollars of the new credit, certainly your prices have not gone up as quickly or as rapidly as the person who's on the back end of that. So inflation certainly, I don't know how much argument there's either, but it certainly is not equal. In other words, the poor, the people who are probably on a fixed income, retired people, certainly are they're hurt the most by inflationary times. And yet if we back around, and here we go back again, cause and effect, understanding what inflation is, just want to use one example, each person would have to then find out if inflation in fact is caused by a certain set of circumstances, where do they fit in that? If inflation is in fact caused by more debt and the country has to print more money, what and how is the debt being generated and to what degree? And if the debt is being generated, and I hear numbers now that we're going to be looking at 60, 70, $80 billion this year as a federal debt. And the total, that's the yearly debt, the total debt is not even over $1 trillion. The interest alone in the debt, $60, $70 billion. I mean, there's numbers I can't even figure out how many zeros there are there. So the point is that we, I think, have a responsibility, Christian or otherwise, understanding, again, cause and effect. If, in fact, the debt was reduced and the federal spending was reduced and inflation was brought down so the poor people might possibly have a chance, would that mean somebody's job here? And most people would say, well, I don't know if it is or isn't, because they don't understand exactly what it is that causes this whole vicious cycle.
And because of that, we tend to see something that doesn't work, so we vote for something else that just might work. And a few years later, we may well vote for something considerably different because it might work.
I personally think the Reagan economics is going to be, in time, considered as big of a farce as the Carter economics, because I think it's being brought forward with a lot of good intentions, but there is no cutting of the budget. It's a cutting of the rate of increase is all it is. And I'm not saying that's bad or good. I think it's bad because inflation could have a very good chance of continuing. And there again, we're hurting the poor people who we're trying to help, if that's what we're trying to do.
Couple minutes. You've been holding off.
I see two levels of discernment here. Of course, we have our year-to-year political sort of battles, and the current one being Reagan or whatever. And yet there is another depth here with entire industrial society being questioned. This is something that just doesn't come up with international elections. I mean, nobody votes. When you vote for either Reagan or Carter, it's fairly assumed that things proceed relatively as is. Yet how many, how far does Barry Commoner get on some sort of an ecological platform? He hardly got any response. People just don't like thinking to limits or, an age of scarcity. And it might come a lot harder than what we think. And maybe we have to start thinking far enough ahead that it's going to be a radical thought.
I just thought perhaps that John Dewey was talking about that.
Okay, just a second, let's break in, Les.
When we were considering the topic for the evening, it occurred to me that it would be an inherently frustrating forum. and I guess I'm going to come back to where I started. I think the reason for that inherent frustration is when we start talking as members of the churches, we realize that the churches have, in this nation, been wholly captured by the American economic success story. We don't have any tradition for thinking about economic life as Christians, which haven't been overwhelmed by the success of our economic life as citizens. And so when the American success story then is on hard times and is rendered doubtful and we experience economic anxiety, then when we do turn to our understandings as Christians, we come up with a blank. There just isn't anything that hasn't been overwhelmed by our cultural experience and economic life. Now, I have a good friend who was the economist for the Presidential Commission on the 80s, which ended the Carter administration and which carried over with the beginning of the Reagan administration. And Bob's contention was, and I thought it was a helpful kind of insight, that Carter is one end of the spectrum, not quite on the end. Reagan is on the other end of the spectrum. The spectrum is, however, the same economics.
Yes.
In the broad sweep. And I remind you that Carter was the first Democrat to propose a budget, namely for this year, which of course didn't become the budget because of the election, that as a Democrat decreased social services spending and increased military spending. The Reagan budget went further in both directions, but the logic was the logic demanded of the basic economic system in place. It's a very good chance that it is that, in the very broadest sense, liberal economics, not like we usually use that term, but liberal in the sense of inherited from the last century and then modified by Keynes and others, it is very likely that that is rendered doubtful, and it's frustrating for us to talk then as Christians because we don't know any other possibility. Because, again, we've been captured by the American success story. However, one of the virtues of capitalism is that it has rewarded creativity and allowed for some space to be created. I think we're in a time which is, while it's threatening and dangerous and it's problematic, is also a time that is kind of exhilarating because we have some opportunity to be creative. The thing that is needed, as David Reisman has often said, is that in times of transition from one major kind of way of organizing life to a different kind of organizing of life, shift in human epoch, changes of ages, the thing that is needed is, and things that are needed, are anticipatory communities. Various experiments here and there that will venture something new, try to pattern life in the space that's available to them differently than it's been patterned in the mass. And as one has to be modest about these things, but even a place like Holden is an effort to ask, is there a way of relating differently economically? Can you do it? Different work patterns? Can you try different energy systems? Can you have different kind of incentives that establish what is valuable work, etc.? Can you pass different kinds of jobs around that people wouldn't dream of organizing in the same way on the outside? Can you get a number of different communities that can try different ways of putting economic life together? And we're beginning to see some of those. Whether the churches will be involved in that or not, I don't know. There are some interesting Christian communities making a try at it. But it's going to be frustrating for a long time.
Ending on a good note. Thank you for the forum.